Airlines Confidential with Ben Baldanza and Scott McCartney is made possible with support from Pratt & Whitney, committed to working smarter, cleaner, and greener today for a more sustainable tomorrow. Learn more at PrattWhitney.com. DoHop, revolutionizing travel connectivity. Learn how to unlock unlimited connections simply at DoHop.com. And Cirium, the world's most trusted source of aviation analytics. Visit Cirium.com. We also welcome your business's support. Info at airlinesconfidential.com.
Welcome to Airlines Confidential. I'm Ben Baldanza, hoping everyone survived tax day on April 15th. You might say this past week came in like a lamb and went out like a lion. We saw two airlines flying in opposite directions financially. It was a week that said a lot about the U.S. airline industry. Scott McCartney.
Yes, it was, Ben. And speaking of learning a lot, I'm looking forward to speaking with Jay Sorensen, our friend who is the world's leading expert on loyalty programs and ancillary revenue. Jay has new research on frequent flyer awards, which airlines make them expensive and which airlines offer good value. I think it's very interesting research and one way to hold airlines accountable for the payback on loyalty.
I'm looking forward to talking with Jay too. Well, one of the big news items of the week was that Delta Airlines kicked off the first quarter earnings season with quite a good performance. Delta posted a narrow profit of $37 million for the three-month period, but that was better than expectations and much better than the net loss of $363 million last year. The first quarter is always tough for airlines, and not all will be posting profits this year in the first quarter. Loyalty revenue was up 12%. Refinery revenue, yes, Delta owns an oil refinery, was up 29%. Total operating revenue was up 8% and set a March quarter record. Interesting, passenger yield was down 2%. Lower fuel prices certainly helped earnings.
Yes, it was somewhat of a mixed bag on fares and revenue, right? Yet Delta CEO Ed Bastian said demand was stronger than he had ever seen. Ed's looking forward into the summer, and it looks like it will be a very busy summer for airlines. I'm still fascinated with the loyalty program impact on Delta, Ben. Delta said it received $1.7 billion from American Express in the quarter. One of every $8 that Delta collected came from American Express. We'll talk with Jay Sorensen about some pretty skimpy values for Delta in terms of payback. And yet the credit card revenue keeps pouring in. Delta said growth of premium cards drove a lot of the increase. I think it will all once again show listeners how important loyalty programs are to airlines and how important perks are to their customers. Loyalty programs aren't so much about free tickets anymore. They are really about airline fee avoidance. The other end of the airline financial news, Ben, was Spirit Airlines, which hasn't yet released its first quarter results, but did announce that it was deferring Airbus deliveries starting now through all of next year and furloughing 260 pilots to save cash. This feels like the start of a redistribution in the industry. I bet United is already pounding on Airbus to get those delivery positions for 321s this year and next that could replace delayed Boeing deliveries of the MAX 9 and 10. There will certainly be demand for those Spirit delivery positions, and I would bet they will go to full-service airlines with strong financial muscle rather than discounters that may not be able to outbid bigger carriers. Same for the pilots. If there is still a pilot shortage in the U.S., it has been dissipating, those Spirit pilots will likely find new jobs in the right seats at bigger airlines. Or maybe they have to take a career step back for a bit and fly for a regional airline, enabling regionals perhaps to get some of their jets grounded by the pilot shortage back into the air. Either way, the point is that it's very, very hard for an airline to shrink its way to profitability. When you shrink, costs go up. Your existing fleet ages and requires more maintenance without the benefit of new jets coming online with virtually no maintenance initially. Your workforce gets more senior and more expensive without cheaper new employees lowering average costs. Yes, you can stop some flying that was your least profitable, or in Spirit's case, I should say most unprofitable, but I'm not sure I've ever seen an airline recover from downsizing without a merger. Which brings me back to the Boston federal judge who thought he was preserving low-fare competition by blocking the JetBlue-Spirit merger. Those deferred Spirit planes and 260 pilots will be flying for higher fare airlines, just as many predicted. And when I say higher fare, I mean higher fare than JetBlue. This is not going to be the outcome the misguided judge and Justice Department thought they were engineering for the traveling public. Lots of us argued Spirit planes and pilots would be put to better use for consumers flying as a stronger fifth competitor to the big four. Instead, it may be the big three that ends up with more planes and pilots from a disintegrating Spirit. That ruling is going to lessen competition, not preserve it.
Spirit is in tough shape. Long before they released their projection about aircraft groundings due to engine issues, GoAir in India shut down for that same reason. Spirit reacted too slowly, I think. They possibly could have least used A320ceos for a few years to mitigate if they had foresight. But maybe that wouldn't have been smart, especially if many of their routes are unprofitable. They made a decision years ago to favor smaller markets like Asheville, Louisville, and Akron over cities where millions live, like Dallas, Chicago, and Los Angeles. In a world where the smaller markets can't stimulate as much, I'm sure this is putting pressure on them. You see Frontier doing the opposite. Shrinking only puts more pressure on Spirit's unit costs. It's all about liquidity for Spirit now, and that is not a good place to be. One other first quarter profit note this week, Breeze Airways, which was founded in 2019 by David Neeleman, said it had an operating profit in the month of March. Breeze most certainly had net losses for the quarter. The private airline doesn't release its full results, but Breeze said the last month of the quarter was its first to be profitable on an operating basis. It's a major milestone. Breeze said unit revenue increased 30% year over year in the month of March.
Congratulations to Breeze. A few other news items I want to mention, Ben. First, Boeing delivered only 83 aircraft in the first quarter, down 36% from 130 last year in the same period. Airbus delivered 142 aircraft, up 12%. Of course, the 737 MAX woes have really disrupted Boeing deliveries. And speaking of constraints in the airline industry, U.S. carriers asked the FAA to extend waivers from slot usage requirements for another year because of the continued New York area air traffic controller shortages. If you were hoping for relief on that problem, forget about it. And last week, we talked about 2023 compensation for United Scott Kirby and Southwest Bob Jordan. Well, at least in terms of compensation, neither of them had as good a year as American's Robert Isom. In fact, Robert's compensation exceeded both of them combined. Isom's total compensation rose to $31.4 million, which included a base salary of $1.3 million, a bonus of more than twice that at $2.75 million, stock awards worth $19.5 million, and something called, quote, non-equity incentive plan compensation, quote, of about $7.8 million. That last category, it seems like a short-term incentive plan that really is a second bonus for achieving specific goals, included payouts for 2022 that were deferred because of the pandemic. Last week, I joked Scott Kirby, who has done an admirable job growing United and winning market share, was no Elon Musk in terms of compensation. Turns out, at least in 2023, he's no Robert Isom either.
While it's not clear which airline CEO is the highest paid in the U.S., we have to wait for Ed Bastian's earnings at Delta. One thing is clear, Airlines Confidential wouldn't exist without our sponsors. We want to thank DoHop, which is revolutionizing travel connectivity. DoHop is a travel technology provider enabling airlines to expand their networks, offer more connectivity, create additional partnerships, and focus on improving the customer experience with more offers, services, and travel options. Airlines benefit from generating additional revenue, lower costs, and maintaining full customer ownership. Plus, in the event of travel disruptions, DoHop works with airlines and offers assistance in helping passengers reach their final destination. Visit DoHop.com. That's DoHop.com.
And we want to thank Cirium. Cirium offers the most accurate and precise data and analytics to enable airlines to optimize planning, operations, and passenger services. The right intelligence drives operational efficiencies, enables you to predict market shifts, and helps airlines respond quickly to maximize revenue, manage costs, and seize commercial opportunity. Visit Cirium.com for more.
In addition, we want to thank Pratt & Whitney. At Pratt & Whitney, the pursuit of more sustainable aviation is foundational. For decades, Pratt & Whitney has been at the forefront of revolutionary advancements in aircraft propulsion technology. And by working smarter, cleaner, and greener today, they are committed to supporting the aviation industry in its goal of reaching net zero CO2 emissions by 2050. Learn more about Pratt & Whitney's smarter technology, cleaner fuel, and greener business at PrattWhitney.com. We're happy to have Jay Sorensen back on the show. Many listeners know that Jay runs IdeaWorks, a consulting firm focused on the tracking and analysis of ancillary revenues and frequent flyer programs. Jay has just released a new report on the state of loyalty programs with some interesting conclusions. Welcome back, Jay.
Thank you, Ben and Scott. I am delighted to be back on the program.
Jay, you produced a closely watched survey on frequent flyer award availability annually up through 2019 and stopped with the pandemic. I've always focused a lot of attention on the IdeaWorks reward seat availability survey because I thought it was the best and really the only solid data assessing both award availability and price. It's based on thousands and thousands of queries for award tickets on lots of different dates, so a broad look at what people can get out of each program. Over the years, you and I kind of shamed airlines with really skimpy award availability, and I think your research helped change the dynamic of programs. You preach that there had to be a real reward in order for these programs to remain attractive, and now they are so attractive that they drive a lot of airline profits. You've restarted the research this year and found some serious change. Let's start with the price of awards. You found that they were significantly increased since 2019. So tell us more about the overall findings and what you think is going on.
Well, actually, the increase in reward prices was 28.3%. And I think in the press release, I refer to inflation. That was above the rate of inflation. And that was actually, I think I want to retract that. I looked at the DOT website, and since 2019, which was the base year for this current press release, fares increased by just about 6%. And so with reward prices increasing by 28.3% or above 28%, that's a very real increase of above average fares for the U.S. market. So it is a significant change. I think there's two things that are driving the changes that are reflected in this current report or this survey, and that is co-branding, which is really driving what is happening at major frequent flyer programs nowadays, as well as basic economy fares.
Now tell us about individual airlines. Which had the lowest prices for a standard domestic award, which had the highest, and which had the biggest change from 2019?
Well, you know, Southwest came in lowest, Ben, at 14,484 points as an average reward level for the queries that we performed. The queries do benefit, Southwest does benefit from their route structure in this regard, in that we took the top markets for each carrier. And for Southwest, their top markets are shorter markets. And so there's an inherent advantage that they have. But even then, their average reward price basically doubled since 2019. In 2019, we found it was 7,367 mile points, which is not quite half of where we are for 2024, but darn close to it. American actually went down. American had the second lowest reward price. In 2019, it was 23,700 miles as the average reward. And for our survey in 2024, it was 17,820. And I should say that I tried to make this an apples-to-apples comparison from 2019 and 2024 by using the same months of travel, June through October, and actually the exact same city pairs for each airline that we queried. And so it is a very real reflection of what has happened since 2019.
And why do you think American has lowered award prices so much? This isn't just catching a sale when you did the research, right?
I don't think that this is an accidental thing. I think that they are being intentional by creating better value with their reward program. And I think what they are, I don't have to think this. I mean, their chief commercial officer has talked about this during quarterly investor calls. And that is, they want to use basic economy fares as a way to introduce the airline to new customers and to effectively compete very strongly with LCCs, and then to slowly convert these customers into regular main cabin customers, have them join the loyalty program, and ultimately have them take the co-branded credit card. You only achieve that end result if these customers find value in the program, and I think that that's what they're trying to do here.
You calculate reward payback, which takes into account both what you paid for the ticket earning miles or points, and then the buying power you get with those miles or points. Why has reward payback dropped? When airlines are collecting more and more revenue from co-branded credit cards and offering some cheap basic economy tickets all over, shouldn't the value consumers get be going up?
So the reward value, the reward payback is an interesting measurement that we created. And what it's effectively what it says is, if I spend a dollar on base fare, what type of return will I receive from that dollar spent? And so for Southwest, Southwest had the highest level of reward payback. So if you spent a dollar on a base fare, effectively we found that you'd get 6.7 cents back in reward value for that dollar spent. United had the second best at 3.3%, and Delta had the lowest at 0.4%. And there are other surveys out there that attempt to evaluate what's happening with reward prices. And from what I can tell, most of them only look at main cabin fares. And I thought that that was a bit disingenuous, because I think many consumers are going to buy a basic economy fare. And why not use that as a way to measure reward payback using basic economy as opposed to main cabin fares? What I was surprised by, and I was not aware to the extent that airlines in the U.S. have really messed with the accrual rules associated with basic economy. And so the survey results are more or less a reflection of what has happened there. And I'll give you a couple of examples. Now, United, which came in second for reward payback, does not mess with accrual for basic economy fares. You get the same type of accrual as you would with a main cabin fare. If you have no status, that's 5 miles per dollar spent. At the other end of the spectrum, you have Delta. And Delta, not surprisingly, came in the bottom with reward payback. If you buy a basic economy fare on Delta, you don't accrue anything. And so I was surprised when I saw this spectrum of what I consider fair treatment of basic economy passengers to treating them as second-class citizens with some carriers.
So reward payback dropped at all six airlines you looked at, but Alaska had a rather large drop from 11.3% to a more average 3.2%. JetBlue 2 saw a big drop from 7.4% to 2.1%. And I guess you could say Delta had the most significant drop from 5.4% to that piddly 0.4% you mentioned. Did those numbers surprise you? Is it all the basic economy effect?
I think it is. You know, for example, with Alaska Airlines, their basic economy accrues at 30% of the miles flown, whereas their main cabin fare accrues 100% of the miles flown. And the result for Delta could have easily have been zero. But in a few cases, the queries that we did not find a basic economy fare, we had a few queries that had only main cabin fares. And that's why they weren't zero, is that there were a few occasions where basic economy was either not offered or was sold out. So, you know, I guess if the reward results would be different if you were to be buying main cabin fares. But I don't believe that it's in the consumer's interest to switch to main cabin fares based purely upon some type of higher reward payback.
So, Jay, this is one more reason why I tell people friends don't let friends fly basic economy. It's not necessarily the accrual of points or miles, but it's all that you give up and all the extra fees you might pay because of what you give up. But this is certainly one more example why basic economy can really work against people.
Well, I was at a client airline site this week, and the topic of basic economy came up in my consulting discussions with the airline. And this was outside the United States. And I don't understand why the U.S. airlines seem to be at war with passengers who want to buy basic economy fares. In talking with my client, I said, it's another fare. It's not these people, these people, I mean, look at the language I'm using. You know, these people are not evil or sinister. They just are value oriented, or they're low price oriented. And there seems to be a feeling among the U.S. majors that somehow we need to punish these passengers for making the mistake of buying a basic economy fare. And I think that's unfortunate, and it places them not at an advantage over LCCs, but, you know, I think in some respects below how an LCC treats their lowest fare passengers.
You're not saying that basic economy customers are deplorable, are you, Jay?
No, I'm not saying that at all. But, you know, I would never say that about hey, I buy these basic economy fares when I can. I am one of these passengers, one of this group. But the issue I have is that these airlines, the big four, the big three, American, Delta, United, position themselves as wanting to be different and better than LCCs. I see that message, that brand message, inconsistent with the behavior.
You also say in the report that basic economy fares are disrupting the value provided by frequent flyer programs through policies that reduce or eliminate mileage point accrual. Explain that more. Some basic economy fares get miles or points and some don't, right? Is that a good idea for airlines to be making it complicated and telling customers they only get miles or points on more expensive tickets?
My big disappointment here is how the whole concept of spend-based accrual has been violated with these exceptions. When spend-based accrual began to appear as opposed to flown mileage accrual, the idea is that passengers or consumers who spend less with the airline will accrue fewer benefits. And so there is an automatic adjustment within that accrual method that says, hey, if you're going to spend a lot of money with us, you're going to get a lot more. In fact, if you have elite status with us, we have a multiplier that's going to be even more rewarding. And so I look at these rules that they have implemented for basic economy as violating the concept of revenue-based accrual. The idea behind revenue-based accrual was simplicity. These exceptions are not simplicity. You know, and of course, the outlier here is United, which has remained consistent in this regard in terms of how they treat accrual for basic economy passengers.
Is there a risk here that programs get so chintzy with rewards that consumers lose interest and move on to cashback credit cards or hotel programs or some other consumer initiative swoops in for that first out-of-the-wallet credit card?
I don't think, you know, I don't think we're, we are heading in that direction. I think the bigger danger to the programs is not so much that they will be seen as not providing value, but that they will be seen as not important to people who buy tickets. Meaning that if most of your accrual is tied to credit card spend, okay, so I can hold a credit card for a particular airline. The accrual that I gain from flying that airline is such a small portion of the relationship, I don't care who I fly. And so I think there's danger in these programs rewarding people for being less loyal to the airline, but instead rewarding them for being more loyal to the credit card.
So based on all this, which airline would you say has the program delivering the best reward values? And is that paying off in program growth and earnings impact?
Well, what's interesting about the results for 2024 as the results compared to 2019, you know, I guess, Ben, the answer is it depends. Now, there's a metric that we haven't talked about yet, and that is the reward value of a mile or point in economy class. And in that particular case, more is better, meaning that if an airline is going to provide more value per mile, that it's the better choice. And here, again, American increased significantly. Back in 2019, it was 0.7 cents. It was the value we placed on a reward mile. In 2024, we found that that was 1.4 cents, which was the leading result among the carriers that we queried. The second place one was 1.2 cents for Southwest, and all the way down to 0.7 cents for United. And so if you're going to accrue miles or points principally through credit card activity, then American and perhaps Southwest are your best choices. JetBlue came in third at 1.1 cent. But you know, American clearly is trying to do something different here in terms of reward value. Now, if you're going to be accruing most of your miles or points by flying the airline, well, then reward payback is your most important metric. And for reward payback, Southwest is above all other carriers at 6.7% reward payback. If you want a reward more quickly, then you're going to want to choose an airline that's going to accomplish that. And again, here, Southwest has the lowest average reward price at $14,484. So, you know, it's a complicated answer.
And it's a complicated loyalty world. Used to be so simple, but more and more complicated every day, it seems. Jay, is there anything else that you found in the research that would be interesting to listeners?
One of the things that we did not put into the press release is we looked at reward payback for different member types, meaning people with different status. And it was interesting, obviously, if you have status, you're going to have better reward payback because of the multiplier used to calculate how many miles or points you're earning is higher. And so in that particular case, for 2024, if you have A-list preferred status on Southwest, we found that the reward payback was 13.5%. Wow. Was the highest in the group. Below that was A-list, which is the status just below A-list preferred at 8.4%. And then below that was United Airlines Premier 1K came in at 7.3%. So clearly, if you have status with these carriers, it does help you generate better reward payback.
No doubt. Well, thanks so much for helping us understand loyalty program complexities and sort through all the differences. And I really appreciate your research holding programs accountable and giving consumers an idea of what they really get for their loyalty. So great to have you with us on Airlines Confidential.
Ben and Scott, great to be back on the program. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for all of your insights, Jay. We'll be right back with more Airlines Confidential.
Promotional consideration provided by thearchive.net, celebrating 20 years with a fresh new look and over 60,000 items of AvGeek goodness. It's the hub of air transport history, and you're welcome aboard thearchive.net.
Thanks again to Jay. I want to remind listeners that Airlines Confidential will be on stage for a keynote podcast at Aviation Festival Americas on May 15th in Miami Beach. This is the 16th year for Aviation Festival Americas, and it brings together more than 250 influential leaders from the U.S., Canada, and Latin America. If you'd like to attend, listeners get a 50% discount by going to airlinesconfidential.com, clicking on the Aviation Festival banner ad, and using the promo code AC50. It's going to be a great event, and we are looking forward to being part of it.
In the mailbag this week, John in Cincinnati wrote to say, "Hello, Scott and Ben. I'm a longtime podcast listener and even longer time admirer of Boeing. I have a concerning question about them, though. The focus of Boeing's leadership changes has recently been, and needs to be, on permanently fixing the operational and quality issues. And I'm confident that they will achieve that. But with all the focus on these immediate issues, is there anyone among the leadership charged with thinking about longer-term strategy, such as the next new aircraft? As you have reported, Boeing was already behind in its planning the next mid-market aircraft. Will the company that so brilliantly conceived and built the 747, 777, and 787 be doing any brilliant conceiving anytime soon? Or will they further cede market leadership to Airbus? What do you think? Please tell me I'm missing something."
John, I'm afraid you're not missing something. Boeing knows it needs a new mid-market aircraft and has considered various options. Yes, there have been teams looking at that, and even some design ideas like a small wide body that could be a 757 replacement. Airlines didn't much like that idea. Boeing set rather lofty goals for fuel savings and basically concluded that new engine designs will be needed before it's worth launching a new narrow-body airplane. So Boeing was basically blaming engine makers for the lack of a new airplane. A lot of people disagree with that and note that even an incremental 10% savings in operating costs would be very attractive to airlines. Typically, the fuel savings increases as refinements to the new airplane get made and advances get made in that aircraft line. You can start at 10%, but the second or third iteration of the new jet may get you to 20% better than the max. You just have to take the plunge and get started, and Boeing is way behind in that, as you note. The big hurdle here is that Boeing has to fix its quality issues before it thinks about launching a new airplane. And Boeing is going to have to somehow get its financial house in order before launching that new airplane. A new airplane is incredibly expensive, and Boeing's cash reserves have been reduced by all the trouble the company is having with its existing product line. Taking on a ton of debt for a new airplane will be a bet the company decision. It can take a decade to get a new plane delivered, and you spend a lot before you start collecting deposits from airlines, let alone deliver airplanes for payment. Boeing should have replaced the 737 long ago. We say that in hindsight, but I think it's one more reflection of a company run by bean counters instead of visionaries. And now Boeing is in a very tough spot, bleeding cash, struggling with leadership, in need of a total cultural revamp. And that's before you take on the monumental task of designing the new airplane. The good news for Boeing is that Airbus hasn't launched a new mid-market airplane yet either, but it kind of has. The A321neo is getting longer and longer range, and it has become the 757 replacement. It's outselling the MAX and certainly out-delivering the MAX. So yes, Boeing is losing market share. Until Boeing makes a move, Airbus can sit back and wait, knowing that it has the best products out there in the mid-size commercial airplane market.
Great question and super response, Scott. The biggest problem for Airbus taking advantage is that they don't have much to sell in the next few years. That's probably why they weren't too upset when Spirit asked for a deferral. Well, that's it for another edition of Airlines Confidential. Have a good week, everyone.
We'll be back next week with more. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is produced by Mass Media. Info at massmedia.net.